Constable Stanley Beer to wait for Negus and bring him along when he arrived, and that I had done so because the only person I could think about at the moment was the man standing beside me. I introduced him. Mr. Samuel Kidd, a boilermaker, and watched with amusement as Poirot recoiled from the dirt-marked shirt with the missing button and the partly unshaven face. Mr. Kidd had nothing as ordinary as a beard or a moustache, but he plainly had trouble using a razor. The evidence suggested that he had started to shave, cut himself badly, and abandoned the enterprise. As a consequence, one side of his face was smooth and hairless, but wounded, while the other was injury-free and covered with dark bristles. Which side looked worse was not an easy question to settle. "Mr. Kidd has a very interesting story to tell us," I said. "I was standing outside the Bloxham waiting for Henry Negus when—" "Ah!" Poirot interrupted me. "You and Mr. Kidd have come now from the Bloxham Hotel?"
"Yes."
"Where did he think I'd come from? Timbuktu?"
"How did you travel?"
"Lazari let me have one of the hotel's cars."
"How long did the journey take?"
30 minutes on the nose."
"How were the roads? Were there many cars?"
"No, hardly anyone about, as a matter of fact."
"Do you think that in different conditions you could have made the journey in less time?" Poirot asked.
"Not unless I grew wings. 30 minutes is jolly good going, I'd say."
"Bon. Mr. Kidd, please sit down and tell Poirot your very interesting story."
To my astonishment, instead of sitting, Samuel Kidd laughed and repeated the very words Poirot had spoken in an exaggerated French accent or Belgian accent or however it is that Poirot speaks.
"Mr. Kidd, please sit down and tell Poirot your very interesting story."
Poirot looked affronted to have his voice mocked. I felt a pang of sympathy for him, until he said,
"Mr. Kidd pronounces my name better than you do, Catchpole."
"Mr. Kidd,"
the dishevelled man guffawed.
"Don't mind me, sir. I'm only entertaining myself. Mr. Kidd."
"We are not here to entertain ourselves," I told him, tired of his antics already. "Please repeat what you told me outside the hotel." Kidd took 10 minutes to tell a story that could have been distilled into three, but it was worth it. Walking past the Bloxham, shortly after 8 o'clock the previous evening, he had seen a woman run out of the hotel, down the steps and onto the street. She was panting and looked frightful. He had started to make his way towards her to ask if she needed help, but she was too fast for him and ran away before he could get to her. As she ran, she dropped something on the floor. 2 gold-coloured keys. Realizing she had dropped them, she turned round and hurried back to retrieve them. Then, clutching them in her gloved hand, she had disappeared into the night. I said to myself, "That's strange, that is, you know, hooking it like that." Samuel Kidd mused. "And then this morning I seen police everywhere, and I asked one of them what was the big to-do. When I heard about these murders, I thought to myself, that could have been a murderer that you saw, Sammy." "She looked frightful, did the lady, frightful." Poirot was staring at one of the many stains on the man's shirt.
"Frightful," he murmured.
"Your story is most intriguing, Mr. Kidd. 2 keys, you say?"
"That's right, sir. 2 gold keys.
"You were close enough to see, yes?"
"Oh, yes, sir. The street's nicely lit up outside the Bloxham. It was no trouble seeing."
"Can you tell me anything else about these keys, apart from their gold colour?"
"Yeah, they had numbers on them."
"Numbers?" I said. This was a detail that Samuel Kidd had not revealed to me in his first telling of the story outside the hotel, nor in his second on the way here in the car. And, dash it all, I should have thought to ask him. I had seen Richard Negus's key, the one that Poirot had found behind the loose fireplace tile. It had the number 238 on it.
"Yes, sir, numbers. Like, you know, 100, 200.
"I know what numbers are," I said brusquely.
"Were those, in fact, the numbers you saw on the keys, Mr. Kidd?" Poirot asked. 100 and 200?
"No, sir. One of them was 100 and something, if I'm not mistaken. The other..."
Kidd scratched his head vigorously. Poirot averted his eyes.
"It was 300 and something, I think, sir. Though I couldn't swear to it, you understand. But that's what I'm seeing now in my mind's eye. 100 and something, 300 and something.
Room 121, Harriet Sipple's room, and Ida Gransbury's, room 317. I felt a hollow space open up in my stomach. I recognized the sensation. It was how I had felt when I first saw the three dead bodies and was told by the police doctor that a gold monogrammed cufflink had been found in each of their mouths. It now seemed likely that Samuel Kidd had been within inches of the murderer last night. A frightful-looking lady. I shivered.
"This woman that you saw," said Poirot, "did she have fair hair and a brown hat and coat?"
He was, of course, thinking of Jenny. I still believe there was no link, but I could see Poirot's reasoning. Jenny had been running around London last night in a state of great agitation, and so had this other lady. It was just about possible they were one and the same person.
"No, sir. She had a hat on, but it were pale blue, and her hair were dark, curled and dark."
"How old was she?"
"Wouldn't like to guess a lady's age, sir. Between young and old, I'd say."
"Apart from the blue hat, what was she wearing?"
"Can't say I took that in, sir. I was too busy looking at her face when I could."
"Was she pretty?" I asked.
"Yeah, but I wasn't looking for that reason, sir. I was looking because I know her, see? I took one look and I thought to myself, 'Sammy, you know that lady.'"
Poirot shifted in his chair. He looked at me, then back at Kidd.
"If you know her, Mr. Kidd, please tell us who she is."
"I can't, sir. That's what I was trying to get straight in my head when she ran away. I don't know how I know her, or her name, or nothing like that. It's not from making boilers I know her, I can say that much. She looked refined, a proper lady. I don't know anybody like that, but I do know her. That face. It's not a face I saw last night for the first time. No, sir."
Samuel Kidd shook his head.
It's a puzzle, all right. I might have asked her if she'd not run away."
I wondered, out of all the people that ever ran away, how many did so for that very reason, because they would rather not be asked, whatever the question might be. Shortly after I had sent Samuel Kidd packing, with orders to search his memory for the name of this mysterious woman, and details of where and when he might have made her acquaintance, Constable Stanley Beer delivered Henry Negus to Pleasance. Mr. Negus was considerably more pleasing to the eye than Samuel Kidd, a handsome man of around 50, with iron-grey hair and a wise face. He was smartly dressed and soft-spoken. I liked him instantly. His grief at the loss of his brother was palpable, though he was a model of self-control throughout our conversation.
"Please accept my condolences, Mr. Negus," said Poirot. "I am so sorry. It is a terrible thing to lose one so close as a brother."
Negus nodded his gratitude. "Anything I can do to help, anything at all, I will gladly do. Mr. Catchpole says that you have questions for me."
"Yes, monsieur. The names Harriet Sipple and Ida Gransbury. They are familiar to you?"
"Were they the other two who were—" Henry Negus stopped talking as Fee Spring approached with the cup of tea he had asked for on arrival. Once she had retreated, Poirot said,
"Yes, Harriet Sipple and Ida Gransbury were also murdered at the Bloxham Hotel yesterday evening."
"The name Harriet Sipple means nothing to me. Ida Gransbury and my brother were engaged to be married years ago."
"So you knew Mademoiselle Gransbury?"
I heard the flare of excitement in Poirot's voice.
"No, I never met her,"
said Henry Negus.
I knew her name, of course, from Richard's letters. He and I rarely saw one another while he lived in Great Holling. We wrote instead. I felt another piece of the puzzle slide into position with a satisfying click. "Richard lived in Great Holling?" I asked, struggling to keep my voice even. If Poirot shared my surprise at this discovery, he did not show it. One village, linking all three murder victims. I repeated its name several times in my mind. Great Holling, Great Holling, Great Holling. Everything seemed to point in its direction.
"Yes, Richard lived there until 1913, said Negus. "He had a law practice in the Culver Valley. It's where he and I grew up, in Silsford. Then in 1913 he came to live in Devon with me, where he's lived ever since. I mean, where he lived."
He corrected himself. His face looked suddenly haggard, as if the knowledge of his brother's death had landed violently upon him once again, crushing him. "Did Richard ever mention to you anyone from the Culver Valley by the name of Jenny?" asked Poirot. "Or anyone at all with that name, perhaps from Great Holling, or perhaps not?"
There was a pause that stretched forward. Then Henry Negus said, "No. What about a person with the initials P.I.J.? No, the only one from the village that he ever mentioned was Ida, his fiancée.
If I may ask a delicate question, monsieur, why did your brother's engagements not result in a marriage?
I'm afraid I don't know. Richard and I were close, but we tended to discuss ideas more than anything else. Philosophy, politics, theology. We did not generally inquire into one another's private business. All he told me about Ida was that he was engaged to be married to her, and then in 1913 that they were no longer engaged.
Attendez. In 1913, his engagement to Ida Gransberry ends, and he also leaves Great Holling to move to Devon and live with you.
And my wife and children, yes.
Did he leave Great Holling in order to put more distance between himself and Miss Gransberry?
Henry Negus considered the question.
I think that was part of it, but it wasn't the whole story. Richard hated Great Holling by the time he left it, and that can't have been only Ida Gransberry's doing. He loathed every inch of the place, he said. He didn't tell me why, and I didn't ask.
Richard had a way of letting you know when he had said all he wanted to say.
His verdict on the village was delivered very much in the spirit of, "That's all there is to it," as I recall. Perhaps if I had tried to find out more...
Negus broke off, an anguished expression on his face.
"You must not blame yourself, Mr. Negus," said Poirot. "You did not cause your brother's death."
I couldn't help thinking that... Well, that something dreadful must have happened to him in that village. And one doesn't like to speak or think about things of that nature if one can help it.
Henry Negus sighed.
Richard certainly didn't want to talk about it, whatever it was, so I took the view that it was better not talked about. He was the one with the authority, you see, the older brother. Everybody deferred to him. He had a brilliant mind, you know.
Indeed.
Poirot smiled kindly.
Oh, no one paid attention to detail like Richard before his decline. Meticulous he was in everything he did. You would entrust anything to him, anybody would. That was why he was so successful as a lawyer, before things went badly wrong. I always believed that he would right himself one day. When he seemed to perk up a few months ago, I thought, finally, he has regained his appetite for life. I hoped he might have been thinking about working again, before every last penny of his money ran out.
"Mr. Negus, if you would please slow down a little," said Poirot, polite but insistent. "Your brother did not at first work when he moved into your home?"
"No. As well as Great Holling and Ida Gransberry,
Richard left behind his profession when he came to Devon. Instead of practising the law, he shut himself away in his room and practised drinking heavily.
Ah, the decline you mentioned.
Yes, said Negus.
It was a very different Richard that arrived at my house from the one I had last encountered. He was so withdrawn and dour. It was as if he had built a wall around himself. He never left the house, saw no one, wrote to no one, received no letters. All he did was read books and stare into space. He refused to accompany us to church and would not relent, even to please my wife. One day, after he had been with us for about a year, I found a Bible outside his door, on the landing floor. It had been in a drawer in the bedroom we had given him. I tried to put it back in there, but Richard made it clear that he wished to banish it from the room. I must confess, after that incident, I asked my wife whether... well, whether we ought to ask him to find a home elsewhere. It was rather disconcerting to have him around, but Clara, that's my wife, she wouldn't hear of it. Family's family, she said. We're all Richard has. You don't turn family out onto the street. She was quite right, of course.
You refer to your brother spending money excessively, I said.
Yes, he and I were both left very comfortably off.
Henry Negus shook his head.
The idea that my responsible older brother Richard would tear through his fortune with no care for the future. And yet that's what he did. He seemed intent on converting what our father had left him into liquor and pouring it down his throat. He was heading for penury and serious illness, I feared. Some nights I lay awake worrying about the terrible end that might lie in store for him. Not murder, though. I never thought for a moment that Richard would be murdered. Though perhaps I should have wondered.
Poirot looked up, instantly alert. Why would you wonder such a thing, monsieur? Most of us assume that our relatives will not be murdered. It is a reasonable assumption in almost all cases. Henry Negus thought for a while before answering. Finally, he said,
"It would be fanciful to say that Richard seemed to know that he would be murdered, for who can know? But from the day that he moved into my house, he had the morose, doom-laden comportment of a man whose life had already ended. That is the only way I can describe it."
"You say, however, that he, perked up in the months preceding his death."
"Yes. Yes, my wife noticed it, too. She wanted me to ask him about it. Women always do, don't they? But I knew Richard well enough to know he would not welcome the intrusion."
"He seemed happier?"
Poirot asked.
"I wish I could say yes to that, Monsieur Poirot. If I could believe that Richard was happier than he had been for years on the day that he died, that would be a significant consolation to me. But no, it wasn't happiness. It was more as if he was planning something. He seemed to have a purpose again, after years without one. That was my impression, though, as I say, I know nothing of what that purpose might have been."
"Yet you are certain you did not imagine this change?"
"Yes, yes, I am. It manifested itself in several ways. Richard got up and came down to breakfast more often. He had more vim and energy about him. His personal hygiene improved. Most noticeable of all was that he stopped drinking. I cannot tell you how grateful I was for that alone. My wife and I prayed that he would succeed, whatever his venture, that finally the curse of Great Holling would release its grip on him and let him enjoy a fruitful life."
"The curse, monsieur? You believe the village to be cursed?" Henry Negus's face reddened.
"Not really, no. Of course there's no such thing, is there? It's my wife's phrase. Deprived of a good yarn to get her teeth into, she dreamed up the notion of a curse, based on Richard fleeing the place and his broken engagement, and the only other fact she knows about Great Holling."
"What other fact?" I asked.
"Oh."
Henry Negus looked surprised. Then he said,
"No, I don't suppose you would know about it. Why should you?
The terrible tragedy of the young vicar of the parish and his wife. Richard wrote and told us about it a few months before he left the village, said Henry. They died within hours of one another.
Did they indeed? What was the cause of their deaths? Asked Poirot.
I don't know. Richard didn't include that detail in his letter, assuming he knew it. He wrote only that it was a terrible tragedy. As a matter of fact, I asked him about it later, but I'm afraid he rather growled at me, which left me none the wiser. I think he was too caught up in his own misfortunes to care to discuss anybody else's.
Chapter 8. Assembling Our Thoughts.
Or else,
said Poirot, as he and I walked briskly from Pleasance in the direction of our lodging-house half an hour later,
all these unhappy events, 16 years ago, are connected. The tragic fate of the vicar and his wife, Richard Negus suddenly ending his engagement to Ida Gransbury, Richard Negus deciding that he loathes Great Olling and must flee to Devon to become an idle spendthrift who drinks himself to death in his brother's house.
You think Richard Negus took to the bottle because the vicar died? I said.
Tempting as it is to make everything tie up, isn't it more likely that the one has nothing to do with the other?
I would not say so, non.
Poirot threw me a sharp look.
Ingest the fresh air of this fine winter's day, Catchpool. It will perhaps help to introduce oxygen to your little grey cells. Take a deep breath, my friend.
I humoured him by doing as he asked. I was, of course, breathing anyway, so it was rather silly.
Bon. Now think of this. It is not merely that the young vicar died tragically. It is that he died only hours after his wife dying. This is most unusual. Richard Negus mentions the incident in a letter to his brother Henry. Several months later, he is no longer engaged to be married to Ida Gransbury. He makes his escape to Devon, where he embarks upon a decline. He refuses to admit a Bible to his room, and will not attend church even to placate the lady of the house.
Why do you say that as though it has a special significance? I asked.
Ah, the oxygen. It takes much time to make its way to the grey cells.
Never mind.
It will arrive eventually where it is most needed, in that pincushion of a brain of yours. Church, Catchpool! A vicar and his wife died tragically in Great Holling. Shortly afterwards, Richard Negus develops an aversion to the village, to church, and to the Bible.
Oh, I see what you're driving at.
Bon. Alors, Richard Negus then takes himself to Devon, where for many years he pursues the decline, during which time his brother does not make any unwelcome intrusion that might save him from the devastation he wreaks upon himself.
You think Henry Negus was negligent in that respect?
It is not his fault, said Poirot with a wave of his hand. He is English. You English would sit by in polite silence while every species of avoidable disaster takes place in front of your eyes, rather than make the social lapse of being seen to interfere.
I'm not sure that's quite fair. I raised my voice to make myself heard against the bluster of the wind and the voices of other people on the busy London street. Poirot ignored my complaint. For many years, Henry Negus worries in silence about his brother. He hopes, and no doubt also he prays, and when he has almost given up hope, it appears that his prayers are answered.
Richard Negus has the visible upward perking a few months ago. He seems to be planning something. Perhaps the plan involved booking 3 rooms at the Bloxham Hotel in London for himself and 2 women he knew from his days in Great Holling, since we know that this is what he did. And then, last night, he is found dead at the Bloxham Hotel with a monogrammed cufflink in his mouth, in close proximity to his former fiancée, Ida Gransbury, and to Harriet Sippel, another villager who was once his neighbour. Both women have been murdered in the same way.
Poirot came to a standstill. He had been walking too fast and was out of breath.
Catchpool, he gasped, mopping his brow with a neatly folded handkerchief that he had pulled from his waistcoat pocket. Ask yourself, What is the first event in this chain of events that I have presented to you? Is it not the tragic deaths of the vicar and his wife?
Well, yes, but only if we allow that they're part of the same story as the three Bloxham murders. There's no evidence of that, Poirot. I still contend that this poor vicar chap might be neither here nor there.
Just as la pauvre Jenny may be neither there nor here.
Exactly. We continued along the street. Have you ever tried to do a crossword puzzle, Poirot? Because, well, you know I'm trying to knock one together at the moment, one of my own.
It would be impossible to reside in such proximity to you as I do and not know, mon ami.
Yes, right. Well, I've noticed something that happens when you're trying to puzzle out a crossword clue. It's interesting. Let's say you have the clue, kitchen utensil, three letters, and you have the letter P as the first letter. It's very easy to think, well, it has to be pot, because that has three letters and begins with P, and a pot is a kitchen utensil. So you tell yourself it must be true, when all the while the right answer is pan, also three letters, also a kitchen utensil beginning with P. Do you see?
That example does not serve you well, Catchpole. In the situation you describe, I would think of both pot and pan as being equally likely to be correct.
Only a fool would consider one and not the other when both fit perfectly. All right, if you want something equally likely to be correct, how about this theory? Richard Negus refused to go to church or have a Bible in his room because whatever misfortune had afflicted him in Great Holling had dented his faith a little. Doesn't that sound as if it could also be a perfect fit? And it might have nothing to do with the deaths of the vicar and his wife. Richard Negus wouldn't be the first to find himself in sore straits and wonder if God loved him quite as much as he seems to love everyone else. That came out more vehemently than I had intended.
Have you wondered this yourself, Catchpole?
Poirot laid his hand on my sleeve to stop me marching along. I sometimes forget that my legs are much longer than his. As a matter of fact, I have. It didn't stop me going to church, but I can see how it would with some people. For instance, those who would object rather than silently concur if told their brains were pincushions, I thought. To Poirot, I said, I suppose it all depends whether you hold yourself or God responsible for your problems.
Did your predicament involve a woman?
Several fine specimens, all of whom my parents fervently hoped I would marry. I stood firm and inflicted myself upon none of them. I started to walk again, briskly. Poirot hurried to catch me up.
So, according to your wisdom, we must forget about the tragically deceased vicar and his wife. We must pretend we do not know about this event, in case we are led by it to a mistaken conclusion. And we must forget about Jenny for the same reason.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that's the right course of action. I'm not suggesting we forget anything, only that
I will tell you the right action. You must go to Great Holling. Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransberry, and Richard Negus, they are not simply three pieces of a puzzle. They are not merely objects we move around in an attempt to fit them into a pattern. Before their deaths, they were people with lives and emotions. The foolish predispositions, perhaps the moments of great wisdom and insight. You must go to the village where they all lived and find out who they are, Catchpole.
Me? You mean us?
Non, mon ami. Poirot,
he will stay in London. I need only to move my mind, not my body, in order to make progress.
No, you will go, and you will bring back to me the fullest account of your travels. That will be sufficient. Take with you two lists of names. Guests at the Bloxham Hotel on Wednesday and Thursday nights, and employees of the Bloxham Hotel. Find out if anyone in this cursed village recognizes any of the names. Ask about Jenny and P.I.J. Make sure not to return until you have discovered the story about this vicar and his wife and their tragic deaths in 1913.
Poirot, you've got to come with me, I said rather desperately. I'm out of my depth with this Bloxham business. I'm relying on you.
You may continue to do so, mon ami. We will go to the house of Mrs. Blanche Unsworth, and there we will assemble our thoughts, so that you do not arrive in Great Holling unprepared. He always called it the house of Mrs. Blanche Unsworth. Every time he did, it reminded me that I too had once thought of it in those terms, before I started to call it home. Assembling our thoughts turned out to mean Poirot standing by the fire in the excessively lavender-fringed drawing-room and dictating to me, while I sat in a chair nearby and wrote down every word he said. I have never, before or since, heard anyone speak in such a perfectly orderly way. I tried to protest that he was making me write down many things of which I was already fully aware, and I got the benefit of his long and earnest disquisition on the subject of the importance of the method. Apparently my pincushion brain cannot be expected to remember anything, and so I needed a written record to refer to. After dictating a list of everything we knew, Poirot followed the same procedure for everything we didn't know but were hoping to find out. I considered reproducing these two lists here, but do not wish to bore or infuriate others, as I was bored and infuriated. To be fair to Poirot, once I had scribbled it all down and looked over what I had written, I did feel that I had a clearer view of things. Clear and inordinately discouraging. I put down my pen and said with a sigh, I'm not sure I want to carry around with me an endless list of questions I can't answer and probably have no hope of ever answering.
You lack the confidence, Catchpole.
Yes. What does one do about that?
I do not know. It is not a problem that I suffer from.
I do not worry that I will meet a problem for which I will be unable to find the solution.
Do you think you'll be able to find the solution for this one?
Poirot smiled.
You wish me to encourage you to have confidence in me, since you have none in yourself,
Mon ami, you know more than you are aware of knowing. Do you remember you made a joke at the hotel about all three victims arriving on Wednesday, the day before the murders? You said, it's almost as if they had an invitation to present themselves for slaughter. One that said, please come the day before, so that Thursday can be devoted entirely to your getting murdered.
Well, what about it?
Your joke relied on the idea that getting murdered is more than enough activity for one day. To travel across the country by train and get murdered on the same day, that would be too much for anyone. And the killer does not want his victims to have to exert themselves unduly.
This is funny.
Poirot smoothed his moustaches, as if he imagined that laughing might have shaken them out of shape.
Your words made me wonder, my friend. Since getting murdered is a really no effort for the victim, and since no killer is so considerate of those he intends to poison, why does he not kill the three victims on the Wednesday night?
He might have been busy on Wednesday night, I said. Then why not arrange for the three victims to arrive at the hotel on Thursday morning and afternoon, instead of Wednesday morning and afternoon? The killer would still have been able to kill them when he did, n'est-ce pas? On Thursday evening, between 7:15 and 8:10.
I did my best to look patient. You're over-complicating things, Poirot. If the victims all knew each other, which we know they did, maybe they had a reason for all being in London for two nights, a reason that had nothing to do with the killer. He chose to kill them on the second night because it was more convenient for him. He didn't invite them to the Bloxham. He simply knew that they would be there, and when. Also, I stopped. No, never mind. It's silly.
Tell me the thing that is silly, Poirot ordered.
Well, it's possible that if the murderer is a meticulous planner by nature, he would not plan the murders for the same day that he knew his victims would be travelling to London, in case their trains were delayed.
Perhaps the killer also had to travel to London, from Great Holling or somewhere else. It is possible that he, or she, for it might be a woman, did not want to make a long, tiring journey and commit 3 murders on the same day.
Even if that's so, the victims could still have arrived on the Thursday, couldn't they?
They did not, said Poirot simply. We know that they arrived the day before, on Wednesday. So, I begin to wonder. Did something need to happen that involved the murderer and all 3 victims before the murders could be committed? If so, then perhaps the murderer did not travel from far to come here, but lives here in London.
Could be, I said. All of which is a long-winded way of saying that we have not the faintest idea of what happened or why. I seem to remember that being my original assessment of the situation. Oh, and Poirot?
Yes, mon ami.
I haven't had the heart to tell you before now, and I know you're not going to like it. The monogrammed cufflinks.
Oui?
You asked Henry Negus about P.I.J. I don't think those are the chap's initials, whoever he is, the owner of the cufflinks. I think his initials are P.J.I. Look. I reproduced the monogram on the back of one of my pieces of paper. As closely as I could from memory, I replicated the way the letters appeared on the cufflinks. Do you see that the I is larger, and the P and the J on either side are considerably smaller? That's a popular style of monogram. The larger initial signifies the surname and is in the middle.
Poirot was frowning and shaking his head. The initials in the monogram are in the wrong order, deliberately?
I have never heard of this. Who would have such an idea? It is nonsensical. Common practice, I'm afraid. Trust me on this one. Chaps at work have monogrammed cufflinks of this sort.
Incroyable. The English have no sense of the proper order of things.
Yes, well, be that as it may, it's P.J.I. we'll need to be asking about when we go to Great Holling, not P.I.J. It was a feeble effort, and one that Poirot saw through straight away.
You, my friend, will go to Great Holling, he said. Poirot will stay in London.
Chapter 9. A Visit to Great Holling. The following Monday morning, I set off to Great Holling as instructed. My impression upon arrival was that it was similar to many other English villages I had visited, and that there was not much more to say about it than that. There is, I think, more difference between cities than between villages, as well as more to say about cities. I could certainly talk at length about the intricacies of London. Perhaps it is simply that I am not as finely attuned to places such as Great Holling. They make me feel out of my element. If I have an element, that is, I'm not convinced that I do. I had been told that I could not fail to spot the King's Head Inn, where I would be staying, but fail I did. Luckily, a bespectacled young man with a boomerang-shaped scattering of freckles across the bridge of his nose and a newspaper tucked under his arm was on hand to help me. He appeared at first behind me, startling me.
"Lost, are you?" he said.
"I believe I am, yes. I'm looking for the King's Head."
"Ah," he grinned. "Thought so, with your case and all. You're not a native, then. King's Head looks like a house from the street, so you'd not notice it, not unless you went along the lane there. See? Go down there, turn right, and you'll see the sign and the way in."
I thanked him, and was about to follow his advice when he called me back with,
"So where are you from, then?"
I told him, and he said, "I've never been to London. What brings you to our neck of the woods, then?"
"Work," I said.
"Listen, I hope this doesn't sound rude, and I'd be glad to talk to you later, but I'd like to get myself settled in first."
"Well, don't let me keep you, then," he said. "What kind of work is it you do?" "Oh, there I go again, asking another question. Maybe I'll ask you later."
He waved and set off down the street. I tried again to proceed to the King's Head, and he shouted after me,
"Down the lane and turn right."
More jovial waving followed. He was trying to be friendly and helpful, and I should have been grateful.
Normally I would have been, except... Well, I'll admit it. I don't like villages. I didn't say so to Poirot before I left, but I said it to myself many times during the train journey, and then again when I got off at the pretty little station. I didn't like this charming, narrow street in which I stood, that curved in the exact shape of a letter S, and had tiny cottages on both sides that looked more suitable for whiskery woodland creatures than for human beings. I didn't like being asked presumptuous questions by complete strangers on the street, though I was fully aware of my own hypocrisy, since I was here in Great Holling to interrogate strangers myself. Now that the bespectacled man had gone on his way, there was not a sound to be heard apart from the occasional bird and my own breathing. Beyond the houses, I saw empty fields and hills in the distance that, combined with the silence, made me feel immediately lonely. Cities, of course, can also make a person feel alone. In London, you look at those who pass you by, and you have no idea what is going on in their minds. Each one looks utterly closed to you and mysterious. In villages, the same rule applies, except that you suspect it is the same thing going on in every mind. The owner of the King's Head turned out to be a Mr. Victor Meakin, who looked to be between 50 and 60, and had thin grey hair through which the tops of his ears poked pinkly on both sides. He too seemed eager to discuss London.
"Were you born there, if you don't mind me asking, Mr. Catchpole? How many people live there now? What's the size of the population? Is it very dirty there? My aunt went there once, said it was very dirty. Still, I always thought I'd like to go one day. I never said so to my aunt, though. I'd have had an argument from her, God rest her soul. Does everyone in London have a car of their own?"
I was relieved that his stream of chatter allowed me no time to answer. My luck ran out when he got to the question that really interested him.
"What brings you to Great Holling, Mr. Catchpole? I can't think what business you might have here."
At that point he stopped, and I had no choice but to answer him. "I'm a policeman," I told him, "from Scotland Yard."
"Policeman?"
He maintained a determined smile, but he looked at me now with very different eyes, hard, probing and disdainful, as if he was speculating about me and drawing conclusions that were to my disadvantage. "A policeman," he said, more to himself than me.
"Now, why would a policeman be here? An important policeman from London, too."
Since he seemed not to be asking me directly, I neglected to reply. As he carried my cases up the winding wooden stairs, he stopped 3 times and turned to peer at me for no discernible reason. The room he had allocated to me was agreeably sparse and chilly, a welcome change from Blanche Unsworth's frilly, fringed extravagance. Here, thankfully, no hot water bottle with a knitted cover had been laid out for my use. I can't bear the things. Even the sight of them irks me. The warmest thing in any bed should always be a person, in my opinion. Meakin pointed out some features of the room that I might have spotted myself, such as the bed and the large wooden cupboard. I tried to respond with the appropriate mixture of surprise and delight. Then, because I knew I would have to do so at some point, I told him the nature of my business in Great Holling, hoping this would satisfy his curiosity and allow him to look at me henceforth in a less penetrating way. I told him about the Bloxham Hotel murders. His mouth twitched as he listened. It looked rather as if he was trying not to laugh, though I might have been mistaken.
"Murdered, you say? In a fancy London hotel? Now there's a thing. Mrs. Sipple and Miss Gransbury murdered. And Mr. Negus."
"You knew them, then?" I said, removing my coat and hanging it up in the cupboard.
"Oh, yes. I knew them."
"They weren't friends of yours, I take it."
"Weren't friends, weren't enemies," said Meakin.
"That's the best way when you've got an inn to run. Friends and enemies gets you into trouble."
"Looks like it got Mrs. Sipple and Miss Gransbury into trouble. Mr. Negus, too."
What was it that I could hear in his voice, that strange emphasis? Was it relish? Forgive me, Mr. Meakin, but does it please you to learn of these three deaths, or am I imagining it? You are, Mr. Catchpole. Indeed, you are. He delivered the denial with utmost confidence. We stared at one another for a moment or two. I saw eyes that gleamed with suspicion, devoid now of all warmth. You told me some news, and I took an interest, is all I did, said Meakin. Just as I take an interest in the tellings of any visitor. It's only right and proper when you've got an inn to run. Fancy that, though. Murder. I turned away from him and said firmly, Thank you for showing me to my room. You've been very helpful. I expect you'll want to ask me a fair share of questions, won't you? The King's Head's been mine since 1911. You'll find no one better to ask. Oh, yes, of course. Once I've unpacked and eaten, stretched my legs a little. I didn't relish the prospect of speaking to this man at length, but it was going to be necessary. One more thing, Mr. Meakin, and it's very important. If you would be kind enough not to pass on what I've told you to anyone else, I'd be grateful. Secret, is it? Not at all, no. It's simply that I would rather tell people myself. You'll be asking questions, will you? There's not a body in Great Ireland who'll tell you anything worth knowing. I'm sure that's not true, I said. You've already offered to talk to me, after all. Meakin shook his head. I don't believe I have, Mr. Catchpole. I said you'll be wanting to ask me, not that I'd be wanting to answer. I will say this, though. He pointed a bony, swollen-knuckled index finger at me. If you've stumbled upon three murders in your fancy London hotel, and keeping in mind that you're a London policeman, you'd be better off asking your questions there and not here. Are you insinuating that you'd like me to leave, Mr. Meakin? Not at all. Your itinerary is entirely your own affair. You'll be welcome at this establishment for as long as you choose to remain. It's no concern of mine. With that, he turned and left. I shook my head in puzzlement. It was hard to reconcile Victor Meakin as he was now with the man who had greeted me when I first walked into the King's Head, who had babbled away merrily about London and his dirt-averse aunt. I sat down on the bed. Then immediately stood up, feeling the need of fresh air. If only there had been somewhere else to stay in Great Holling, apart from the King's Head. I put on the coat I had taken off a few minutes earlier, locked my room, and descended the stairs. Victor Meakin was drying beer glasses behind the bar. He bowed as I entered the room. In the corner, on either side of a table that was covered in glasses, both full and empty, sat two men, who were intent upon becoming as intoxicated as possible. Both had perfected the art of swaying while seated. One of these determined drinkers was a decrepit old gnome of a chap with a white beard who brought to mind Father Christmas. The other was well-built and square-jawed, and could not have been older than 20. He was trying to speak to the old man, but his mouth was too slack from the liquor, and he couldn't make himself understood. Fortunately, his drinking companion was in no fit state to listen, so it was perhaps lucky that it was unintelligible nonsense that was going to waste and not the finest repartee. The sight of the young man disturbed me. How had he ended up at such a low ebb? He looked as if he was trying on a face that, if he didn't change his habits, he would soon be doomed to wear for ever. "Would you care for a drink, Mr. Catchpole?" Meakin asked. "Perhaps later, thank you." I smiled warmly. I try to make a point of being as good-humoured as I can with those I dislike or don't trust. It doesn't always work, but sometimes they respond in kind. First, time to stretch the old legs. The inebriated young man rose unsteadily to his feet. He seemed suddenly angry, and said something that began with the word no. The rest was unintelligible. He staggered past me and out onto the street. The old man raised his arm, a process which took him nearly 10 seconds, until his finger was pointing straight at me.
"You," he said.
I had been in the village of Great Holling for less than an hour, and already two men had pointed rudely straight at my face. Perhaps among the local folk this was a sign of welcome, though I doubted it. "I beg your pardon," I said. Father Christmas made sounds that I translated as, "Yes, you, good fellow, come and sit down here, in this chair, here, next to me, here, the chair that the unfortunate young ne'er-do-well no longer has the need of, here." Under normal circumstances, the repetition might have grated, but since I was engaged in a translation exercise, I rather welcomed it. "Actually, I was about to take a stroll around the village," I started to say, but the old man had made his mind up that I should do no such thing.
"There's plenty of time for that later," he barked. "Now, you'll come and sit down, and we'll have ourselves a talk."
To my alarm, he began to sing.
"Come and sit down, come and sit down, Mr. Policeman from London Town."
I looked at Meekin, who kept his eyes on his beer glasses. Anger emboldened me, and I said to him, "I seem to remember asking you only 10 minutes ago not to discuss my business with anybody."
"I haven't said a word."
He did not even have the good grace to look at me. "Mr. Meekin, how has this gentleman found out that I'm a policeman from London, if not from your telling him? Nobody else in the village knows who I am."
"You mustn't go leaping to conclusions, Mr. Catchpole. That'll get you nowhere, I expect. I've said not a word about you to a single body, not a word."
He was lying. He knew that I knew, and he didn't care. Defeated, I went and sat with the old gnome-like man in his corner of the inn. There were hops and brasses on the dark beams all around him, and for a second he struck me as a strange white-haired creature in an even stranger nest. He started to talk as if our conversation were already in full swing.
"Not a gentleman, but a ne'er-do-well, and his parents are the same way. They can't read or write their own names, nor can he. No Latin to speak of. 20 years of age, and look at him. When I was his age. Oh, but that was long ago. Time immemorial. I made the best of myself as a young man. But some take the blessings of the Lord bestowed and squander them all. They don't realize that greatness is within the grasp of every man, so they don't try to achieve it."
"Latin, eh?" was all I could manage by way of reply. "Greatness?" I counted myself as lucky every time I avoided a humiliating failure. There was nothing coarse about the old man's voice, in spite of his lumpy, claret-coloured nose and ale-soaked beard. Undistorted by drink, his was a voice one might be pleased to listen to, I thought. "So, have you done great things, then?" I asked him.
"I've tried, and I've succeeded beyond my wildest dreams."
"Have you really?"
"Ah, but that was long ago. It doesn't pay a man to dream. The dreams that matter most can never come true. I didn't know that when I was young. I'm glad I didn't."
He sighed.
"What about you, my good fellow? What will be your great achievement? Solving the murders of Harriet Shipple, Ida Gransbury, and Richard Negus?"
He spoke as if this were an unworthy goal.
"I never knew Negus. Though I saw him once or twice," he went on. shortly after I arrived in the village. He left it. One man comes, another man goes, and both for the very same reason, both with the heaviest of hearts.
What reason? The old gnome poured an almost impossible amount of ale down his throat in one swift motion.
She never got over it,
he said. Who never got over what? Do you mean that Ida Gransbury never got over Richard Negus leaving Great Holling?
The loss of her husband, or so they say, Harriet Sipple. They say it was losing him so young that made her what she was. I say that's a poor excuse. Not much older than the kid that was sitting where you're sitting before you were sitting there. Too young to die. There's no end to them.
When you say made her what she was, I wonder what you meant by that, Mr. Can you explain?
What, my good fellow? Oh, yes. Yes, it doesn't pay a man or a woman to dream. I'm glad I was old by the time I tumbled to that.
Forgive me, but I'd like to check I've got this right, I said, wishing he would stick to the point. Are you saying that Harriet Sipple lost her husband at a young age, and that being widowed was what made her become... what? To my horror, the old man started to cry.
Why did she have to come here? She could have had a husband, children, a home of her own, a happy life.
Who could have had those things? I asked rather desperately. Harriet Sipple?
If she hadn't told an unforgivable lie, that was what started all the trouble.
As if an invisible participant in the conversation had suddenly asked him another question, the old man frowned and said,
No. Harriet Sipple had a husband, George. He died young, a terrible illness. He wasn't much older than the kid, the ne'er-do-well that was sitting before where you're sitting now. Stokely.
The ne'er-do-well's name is Stokely, is it?
No, my good fellow, my name is Stokely. Walter Stokely. I don't know his name.
The old gnome combed his fingers through his beard, then said,
"She devoted her life to him." Oh, I know why. I've always understood why. He was a substantial man, whatever his sins. She sacrificed everything for him.
For the young man who was here just now? No, that seemed unlikely. The ne'er-do-well had not looked substantial. It was lucky that Poirot wasn't party to this conversation, I thought. Walter Stokely's disorganized ramblings would have given him a seizure.
Oh, no. He's only 20, you know.
Yes, you told me a few moments ago.
No point devoting your life to a wastrel who spends his days drinking.
I agree, but
she couldn't marry some kid, not once she'd fallen in love with a man of substance. So she left him behind.
I had an idea, inspired by what the waiter, Raphael Bobak, had said in the dining room of the Bloxham Hotel. Is she many years older than him? I asked.
Who?
Stokely looked puzzled. The woman you're talking about. How old is she?
A good 10 years older than you. 42, 43 in an estimate.
I see. I couldn't help being impressed that he had guessed my age accurately. If he was able to do that, I reasoned, then surely I would eventually manage to draw some coherent sense from him. Back into the discursive chaos I went.
So the woman you're talking about is older than the ne'er-do-well, who was sitting here in this chair a few minutes ago.
Stokely frowned.
Why, my good fellow, she's more than 20 years older than him. You policemen ask peculiar questions.
An older woman and a younger man. the very pairing that Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransbury, and Richard Negus had been overheard gossiping about at the Bloxham Hotel. I was definitely making progress. So she was supposed to marry the ne'er-do-well, but then chose a more substantial man instead?
No, not the ne'er-do-well, said Stokely impatiently.
Then his eyelids flickered. He smiled and said,
Ah, but Patrick, he had greatness within his grasp. She saw it. She understood. If you want women to fall in love with you, Mr. Catchpool, show them you have greatness within your grasp.
I don't want women to fall in love with me, Mr. Stokely.
Why ever not?
I took a deep breath. Mr. Stokely, could you please tell me the name of the woman you were talking about, the one you wish hadn't come here, who fell in love with a more substantial man, and who told the unforgivable lie?
Unforgivable, the old gnome agreed.
Who is Patrick? What is the rest of his name? Are his initials PJI? And is there, or was there ever, a woman by the name of Jenny in Great Holling?
Greatness in his grasp, said Stokely sadly.
Yes, quite, but...
She sacrificed everything for him, and I don't think she would say she regretted it if you asked her today. What else could she do? She loved him, you see. There's no arguing with love.
He clutched at his shirt and twisted it.
You might as well try to rip out your heart.
Which was rather how I felt after a further half hour of trying to extract some logic from Walter Stokely. I applied myself until I could bear it no longer, and then gave up. Chapter 10 Slander's Mark. I stepped out of the King's Head Inn with great relief. A light rain had started to fall. In front of me, a man wearing a long coat and a cap broke into a trot, no doubt hoping to reach his house and get himself inside before the weather worsened. I gazed out across the field that was opposite the pub, beyond a low hedge, a sizable expanse of green bordered by rows of trees on three sides. Again, that silence. Nothing to hear but the rain on the leaves, nothing to see but green. A country village was the wrong place to live for anyone who wanted to be distracted from their own thoughts, that was for sure. In London, there was always a car or a bus or a face or a dog whizzing past, making some sort of commotion. How I longed for commotion now. Anything but this stillness. Two women passed me, also apparently in a hurry. They ignored my friendly greeting and scuttled away without looking up. It was only when I heard over my shoulder the words, policeman and Harriet, that I wondered if I had blamed the perfectly innocent rain for a phenomenon of my own making. Were these people running from the weather, or from the London policeman? While I had been applying my little grey cells, as Poirot would call them, to Walter Stokely's disjointed proclamations, had Victor Meakin left his inn by the back door and stopped passers-by on the street to inform them of my presence in the village against my clearly stated wishes? I could imagine that might be his idea of sport. What a strange and unpleasant man he was. I continued along the S-shaped street. Ahead of me, a young man emerged from one of the houses. I was pleased to see that it was the man with the glasses and freckles whom I had met when I first got off the train. When he saw me strolling towards him, he stopped as if the soles of his shoes had been glued to the pavement.
"Hello," I called out. "I found the King's Head, thanks to your help."
The young man's eyes widened as I approached. He looked as if he wanted to hook it. Evidently he was too polite to do so. If it hadn't been for that distinctive boomerang of freckles across his nose, I might have concluded that this could not be the same person I met before. His manner had totally altered, exactly as Victor Meekins had.
"I don't know anything about who killed them, sir,"
he stammered before I had an opportunity to aim a question at him.
"I don't know anything.
I've never been to London, like I told you.
Well, that put the matter beyond doubt. My identity and reason for being in Great Holling were common knowledge. Silently I cursed Meekin.
It isn't London that I'm here to find out about, I said.
Did you know Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransbury and Richard Negus?
I can't stop, sir, I'm afraid. I have an errand.
He was calling me sir all over the place. He had not done so the first time we spoke, before he knew I was a policeman.
Oh, I said. Well, might we speak later today?
No, sir, I don't think I'll be able to spare the time.
How about tomorrow?
No, sir.
He chewed his bottom lip.
I see. And if I forced the issue, I dare say you would only clam up or lie, wouldn't you?
I sighed.
Thank you for exchanging these few words with me, at any rate. Most people see me coming and hair off in the opposite direction.
It's no reflection on you, sir.
People are scared.
Of what?
Three are dead. No one wants to be next.
I don't know what answer I was expecting, but it wasn't that one. Before I could reply, the young man darted past me and marched off down the street. What, I wondered, made him believe that there was likely to be a next? I thought about Poirot's mention of a fourth cufflink waiting in the murderer's pocket to be placed in a future victim's mouth, and my throat tightened involuntarily. I could not allow the possibility of another laid-out body, palms facing downwards.
No, that was absolutely not going to happen. Announcing this to myself made me feel better.
I walked up and down the street for a while, hoping to catch sight of someone else, but nobody appeared. I was not yet ready to return to the King's Head, so I walked to the very end of the village where the railway station was. I stood on the platform for the London trains, frustrated that I could not board one and return home immediately. I wondered what Blanche Unsworth would cook for dinner tonight, and whether Poirot would judge it to be satisfactory. Then I forced my thoughts back in the direction of Great Holling. What could I do if everybody in the village had resolved to avoid and ignore me? The church. I had strode past its graveyard several times without noticing it properly, without thinking about the tragic story of the vicar and his wife who had died within hours of each other. How could I have been so oblivious? I walked back into the village and made straight for the church. It was called Holy Saints, and was a smallish building of the same honey-coloured stone as a railway station. The grass in the churchyard was well tended. Most of the graves had flowers by them that appeared newly laid. Behind the church, on the other side of a low wall into which a gate had been fitted, I saw two houses. One, set back, looked as if it must be the vicarage. The other, much smaller, was a long, low cottage, the back of which was almost pressed up against the wall. It had no back door, but I counted four windows, large ones for a cottage, that would have afforded views of nothing but rows of gravestones. One would have to be made of strong stuff to live there, I thought. I opened the iron gates and walked from the street into the churchyard. Many of the headstones were so old that the names were illegible. Just as I was thinking this, a new and rather handsome one caught my eye. It was one of the few by which no flowers were laid, and the names carved upon it made my breath catch in my throat. It couldn't be. But surely it had to be. Patrick James Ive, vicar of this parish, and Frances Maria Ive, his beloved wife. P.J.I. It was as I had explained to Poirot. The larger initial in the middle of the monogram was the first letter of the surname. And Patrick Ive was once the vicar of Great Holling. I looked again at the birth and death dates to check I had not made a mistake. No, Patrick and Francis Ive had both died in 1913, he at the age of 29 and she at 28. A vicar and his wife, who had died tragically within hours of one another. His initials, on three cufflinks that ended up in three murder victims' mouths at the Bloxham Hotel. Confound it all. Poirot was right, loath though I was to admit it. There was a link. Did that mean he must also be right about this Jenny woman? Was she connected too? Beneath the names and dates on the gravestone, there was a poem. It was a sonnet, but not one I knew. I started to read. That thou art blamed shall not be thy defect, for slander's mark was ever yet the fair. I had only read the first two lines when a voice spoke behind me and prevented me from getting any further. The author is William Shakespeare. I turned and saw a woman of 50 or thereabouts, with a long and somewhat bony face, hair the colour of horse chestnuts with the odd streak of grey here and there, and wise, watchful grey-green eyes. Pulling her dark coat tight around her body, she said, "There was much debate about whether the name William Shakespeare ought to be included." "Pardon?" "Beneath a sonnet. In the end, it was decided that the only names on the stone should be..." She turned away, suddenly, without finishing her sentence. When she turned back to me, her eyes were damp. "Well, it was decided that..." By which I mean that my late husband Charles and I decided... Oh, it was me, really, but Charles was my loyal supporter in everything I did. We agreed that William Shakespeare's name received plenty of attention one way and another, and did not need to be carved there, too. She nodded at the stone. "Though when I saw you looking, I felt obliged to steal up on you and tell you who wrote the poem." "I thought I was alone," I said, wondering how I could have missed her arrival, facing towards the street as I had been. "I entered through the other gate," she said, pointing over her shoulder with her thumb. "I live in the cottage. I saw you through my window." My face must have betrayed my thoughts on the unfortunate situation of her home, because she smiled and said, "Do I mind the view? Not at all. I took the cottage so that I could watch the graveyard." She said this as though it were a perfectly normal thing to say. She must have been reading my mind, for she went on to explain, "There is only one reason that Patrick Ives' gravestone has not been dug out of the ground, Mr. Catchpool, and it is this. Everybody knows I am watching." She advanced upon me without warning and held out her hand. I shook it. "Margaret Ernst," she said. "You may call me Margaret." "Do you mean... Are you saying that there are people in the village who would wish to disturb Patrick and Francis Ives' grave?" "Yes. I used to lay flowers by it, but it soon became apparent that there was little point. Flowers are easy to destroy, easier than a slab of stone. When I stopped leaving the flowers, there was nothing for them to destroy apart from the gravestone itself. But I was in the cottage by then, watching." "How appalling that anybody would do such a thing to another person's resting place," I said. "Well, people are appalling, aren't they? Did you read the poem?"
"I started to, and then you appeared."
"Read it now," she ordered. I turned back to the stone and read the sonnet in its entirety. "That thou art blamed shall not be thy defect, for slander's mark was ever yet the fair. The ornament of beauty is suspect, a crow that flies in heaven's sweetest air. So thou be good, slander doth but approve thy worth the greater, being wooed of time. For canker vice the sweetest buds doth love, and thou presentest a pure unstained prime. Thou hast passed by the ambush of young days, either not assailed or victor being charged. Yet this thy praise cannot be so thy praise, to tie up envy evermore enlarged. If some suspect of ill masked not thy show, then thou alone kingdoms of hearts shouldst owe."
"Well, Mr. Catchpool?"
"It's a peculiar poem to fetch up on a gravestone."
"Do you think so?"
"Slander's a strong word. The poem suggests that, well, unless I'm mistaken, that there were attacks upon..."